So first and foremost, I would like to thank the pastor, both pastors, for welcoming me to the church today, and I would like to thank all of you for welcoming me into this place of worship and for giving up your Sunday to listen to what I have to say. I grew up in Ireland, and when growing up, we were always told, never talk about religion and politics at the dinner table. And today I'm going to break that taboo because I'm going to talk about both religion and politics. And I'm going to do it by recalling a famous speech that was delivered in 1965 by President Lyndon Johnson. It was a speech that was designed to call us to a higher purpose. A particular higher purpose at that time was civil rights and voting rights specifically. Today I'm going to use that particular speech to call us all to a higher purpose, specifically the higher purpose of not just addressing climate change, not just managing the risk of environmental degradation, but the purpose and the calling of building a better world, a world that is more inclusive, where prosperity is shared, where our common home is properly protected. And the reason I'm doing that is because we're not only joined together today on Sunday, a day of worship, but we're joined together on President's Day weekend. So it seems appropriate to bring presidential history and scripture together. And what you've just heard from my predecessor to the pulpit here is scripture that was used by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965 to speak about civil rights. And I want to read to you what the president had to say on that March evening, long ago. He said, "And should we defeat every enemy, and should we double our wealth and conquer the stars, and still be unequal to this issue, then we will have failed as a people and as a country. For with a country as with a person, what is a man profited if he shall gain the world and lose his own soul? What is a man profited if he shall gain the world and lose his own soul?" Now, when President Johnson delivered those words before a joint session of Congress, he was trying to do two things. First of all, he was trying to help us understand that we cannot care for the important while neglecting the essential. It is absolutely important that we increase our wealth. It is absolutely important that we defeat our enemies. But we must always come back to what is essential. And I'm going to argue in a moment that addressing climate change is essential, not because it protects ecosystems, not because it safeguards the planet, but because it is fundamental to our own human security, our own lives, our own health, our own jobs, and ultimately our lives. President Johnson was making a second argument that evening. He was saying, what use is it to care for the material if we fail to care for the moral? His argument was that the fundamental principles, values, and even mission of the United States was the expansion of freedom, the expansion of equality, caring for each other as a community. And in the pursuit of material benefits, growing our economy, providing jobs, becoming the economic behemoth of the 20th century, we had neglected and failed to advance the fundamental cause of the United States, the expansion of freedom. Freedom to the marginalized, freedom to the vulnerable, freedom to the low-income populations, freedom across gender and across races. Those two calls, the call to concentrate on the essential as well as the important, and the call to focus on the moral as well as the material, are equally relevant when we begin to discuss the issue of climate change. Now, to many people, climate change can seem extremely complicated. It's a scientific phenomenon. It is something we hear about all of the time in political and scientific discord. But in fact, it is extremely straightforward. There's an author called Nate Silver who said, climate change is not rocket science. It predates the toaster oven. The point being, it's actually quite simple science. Greenhouse gas pollution caused by the way we use energy, the way we use transportation, the way we use land for agricultural purposes, the industrialization processes that we have experienced for the last 200 years. These activities, all of which are human activities, send pollution into the atmosphere. That pollution changes the chemical composition of the atmosphere that protects the Earth. that ensures we have the right balance of light and heat so that we have a climate that is conducive to our survival as a species. The change in composition of the atmosphere has impacts. First and foremost, it leads to an increase in global temperatures. As a consequence of that increase in global temperatures, we see an increase in the intensity and frequency of extreme weather events. We see, for example, the Atlantic hurricane seasons increasing in intensity and frequency. We see the impact that those hurricanes have in Florida and in Puerto Rico and in the Carolinas. We see that in Puerto Rico, 3,000 people lost their lives prematurely as a result of Hurricane Maria. We see right across the southern belt of this nation, billions of dollars worth of damage being done to homes and infrastructure, to schools, to places of worship, to hospitals. Money being lost that could be reinvested in healthcare, in education, in job creation. We see the wildfires of California destroying communities and homes. And of course, we see an increase in vector-borne and waterborne diseases. Things like Lyme's disease, which has tripled in number in the last decade, with more than 300,000 Americans now reporting that they are contracting Lyme's disease. A devastating illness for an individual, but also an illness that can undermine the economic prosperity of a household. It can take an individual income earner out of the job market, plunging his or her family into poverty. We see changes in water distribution around the world. Places that are susceptible to drought, more susceptible than they used to be. Places that are flooded, more susceptible to flooding. And these all have implications on human system. Because when a farmer cannot farm, he takes to the streets of Damascus to protest. And when his government does not like the process of protesting, the government cracks down. And we see a civil war resulting in hundreds of thousands of deaths and mass migration. We see national security consequences all around the globe that prompt the United States military to send men and women in uniform into action in fragile states. We see people losing their jobs. We see people losing their homes. We see human rights undermined. The right to an education, the right to food, the right to development, the right to health, the right to life itself. The truth of the matter is, when we set about protecting the climate, we're not doing it to protect polar bears or ice caps. We're doing it to protect ourselves. We're doing it to make sure that we can build an economy that is prosperous for everybody and that we have the necessary conditions for our own survival and our own thriving in the future. So climate change and the action that we pursue is essential, not just important, but it is also the moral thing to do, because the unfortunate reality of climate change is that those who have done the least to cause the problem are those who are disproportionately impacted by it. If you look around the world, the most important statistic I have ever presented on climate change is not a scientific statistic, it's about women. It's that 90% of all fatalities to extreme weather events in Bangladesh are women. This is not because the women are exposed to a hurricane that the men are not exposed to. It's because the women cannot leave home without a male guardian. It's because they've never been taught how to swim. It's because they've never been taught how to climb a tree. It's because they cannot inherit the land when their spouse or father passes away. It's because they don't have access to financial resources, so they cannot count on credit or savings to rebuild their lives when their lives are decimated by an extreme event. It's because they don't have access to information, so they do not know when the storm is approaching and cannot evacuate. It's that they do not have access to political decision-making, so they cannot work with their local government to build resilient systems that will protect them from the storm. That is not just a Bangladesh statistic, that is a statistic reflected across the globe. It is a statistic reflected in the outcomes of Superstorm Sandy in New York and Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. It is not just affecting women, it affects people of color, it affects the old and the young, it affects marginalized communities and low-income populations. It affects anyone that is the victim of structural discrimination and intersecting inequalities. People who are faced with cultural, social, political, economic, or legal inequalities are excluded from from the resources they need to manage climate risk and build a life of resilience. So this is a moral calling, because it's not just about protecting the environment. It's about protecting the least amongst us. It's about making sure that as we go about our action on this issue, that we consider the human dimension and not just the environmental dimension. Now, we know, as a consequence of science, but also as a consequence of what we see before our eyes on a daily basis, that this problem is getting worse as a consequence of inaction. We know, for example, that we are losing trillions of dollars of economic opportunity around the world as a consequence of failing to mobilize properly on this issue. And we know that the people who are most vulnerable are people who are excluded. So, for example, if you look at the hurricanes that recently passed through Carolina, both north and south, these were unusual hurricanes. They weren't just characterized by their wind speed. They were characterized by how much moisture they were able to carry. And when the moisture fell on North and South Carolina, there were people in those states who had wind insurance but don't have flood insurance, because only 14% of Americans have flood insurance. And so not only do these people have to deal with an extreme event, but they have to deal with the prospect of rebuilding their lives without support from the private sector or from their own government. So this is a problem that is accelerating. Now, here is the good news. The good news is we know everything we need to know to manage this problem. We have all the technological innovation we need to build a low-carbon, clean energy future. The good news is we have all of the money we need to tackle this problem. The global economy is worth $100 trillion. The problem here is not a lack of money. The problem here is an inappropriate way of distributing that money, of using those resources. We have all the political will in the world we need to tackle this issue. Right around the globe, 189 countries have put in place national climate action plans to reduce emissions in their energy and transport and land use sectors, to catalyze low carbon climate resilient growth right across their economies. The Paris Agreement from 2015 has 196 countries as signatories. Every country on the face of the earth. There is one country that is thinking about leaving the Paris Agreement, and that is the United States. But every other country around the world is committed to a process of deep decarbonization. That means not only tackling the climate problem, it also means job creation, economic development, creating societies that are inclusive, not only economically, but also politically as well. So we have the technology, we have the finance, we have the political will. We also have a framework for how we might go about this action in our own lives. You, for example, each individual in this congregation, you can decide today to leave this place of worship and act. You can think about the energy you use and switch from fossil fuels to renewable energies. You can think about the amount of energy you use and concentrate on energy efficiency. You can think about how you move yourself, your family, your goods and services by working to purchase, for example, low-carbon automobiles, a hybrid car, an electric car. You can think about your home, how you heat it, and you can think about what you eat. You can think about changing your diet. There are simple steps that we can take as individuals that cumulatively make a big contribution to how we go about safeguarding our planet and building an inclusive world. But your purpose does not need to stop with action, because you can also enable other people to lead. You are enabling me to lead today by giving me a platform to speak. And you can enable other people within your family, within your community, by becoming educators on this issue. When you hear people saying that this is a hoax, you can debate them. Not argue, not criticize, not judge, but you can educate. You can help those people understand that, in fact, the global consensus is real. Because not only 196 countries around the world are acting on this issue, but 6,000 companies representing half the global economy have taken climate commitments. This includes the highest emitting companies in the world. So ask yourself, if Saudi Arabia as an oil-producing country is willing to lead on this issue, if ExxonMobil, whose entire profitability is dependent on oil, is willing to lead on this issue, if 97% of all the science agrees on this issue, then what room is there left for us to consider this a hoax? You can enable people by also educating them on the steps that they can take in their own daily lives to lead on this issue. And you can follow the model established earlier in this church by focusing on educating our children. You can work to build a social consensus, because our ability to lead on this issue is going to depend on our ability to come together as a population and to put aside the tribalism and polarization and politicization of this issue. This is not a Republican or Democratic issue. If you look right around the globe, every spectrum of ideology, from the theologians of Iran to the communists of China, from the Christian Democrats of Germany to the socialists of South America, every part of the political spectrum agrees on this issue. So there is no need for us in this country to fall into confrontation and political dispute. And then finally, in addition to acting and enabling, you can also seek to influence. Because one of the most important things to remember is that we have power, we have agency. We can influence the way companies behave by how we choose to spend our money. We can spend that money locally. And when we go and purchase from major corporations, we can let them know that our consumer choices are determined by how they behave as stewards of our people and stewards of our environment. And we can use the power that is given to us in our democracy, the power to vote. The noted climate scientist Jim Hansen recently said, "We cannot fix the climate until we fix our democracy." And what he meant by that was that too few people in this country come out to vote, that there are too many impediments to voting in this country, that our political system seems unresponsive to the will of the people, that often we are faced with candidates who are unpalatable. The message there is not to become distracted or disenchanted. The message there is, come out and participate. Vote, and if you don't like who you're voting for, stand for election. The power to influence is the power of the purse and is the power of the vote. These are powers that many populations around the globe do not have at their disposal, but we have them here and we need to use them. What I'm doing here today is I'm explaining a set of values and I'm explaining a roadmap for action. These are not the values of an environmentalist. These are not the values of an Irishman. These are not the values of a scientist. I am asking you to care for creation. I am asking you to be stewards of Earth. I am asking you to care for the least amongst us. I am asking you to expand and participate in democracy. These are Christian values. These are American values. So when you leave this congregation today, when you step out into your neighborhoods, I'm not asking you to become a climate scientist. I'm asking you to live your own values in your daily lives. As has been mentioned earlier, we will have a conversation when our worship ends. And I hope you will join that conversation. I hope you will ask any question that is on your mind. I will happily answer any question raised. I will go deeper into the weeds of the science or the politics. But the key lesson here today is take these values out into the world and live them on a daily basis. Thank you again for the invitation, and thank you for giving me your ear, and hopefully for giving me your heart as well in this conversation.